Hi everyone, and welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Andreas Steno Larsen, sending to you live Wednesday, September 28th. After another bizarre day in financial markets, we've had direct intervention from the Bank of England in the UK bond market to try and slow down the rising interest rates in the long end of the yield curve. So today we're going to ask the question whether this mayhem in the British markets is a canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world. And with me to discuss that question, I have a friend of mine, a great analyst, and a guy who follows this situation very closely. Darius Dale, it's good to see you.
Andreas, what's up, brother? How are you?
I'm good. I mean, it's been a crazy day after this action in the UK bond market. So we've actually had a pretty material positive repricing of equities on the back of this intervention in the British bond market. What do you make of the situation, Darius?
Yeah, so I mean, it goes back to what's been the key driver of asset markets this year, right? It's been, you know, the repricing both on the short and long end of sovereign debt curves. We've seen central banks step away in terms of being there on the demand side and also on the policy rate side, actually trying to cause harm. But we're also seeing fiscal authorities continuing to march forward as it relates to fiscal expansion and supporting their populations through this inflationary time that obviously folks like us would very clearly say they're causing. But that's neither here nor there.
Yeah, let's have a look at what actually happened in the UK today. I think we can bring up chart one, Brian. I tried to sort of create a sketch of what happened in the British bond market because early this morning, European time, the rumors started circulating on a couple of pension funds being under pressure due to margin calls on receiver swaps. So they've basically received fixed interest rates in swap agreements. And when the far end of the yield curve accelerates like crazy, which is what we've seen in the UK over the past couple of weeks, these swap agreements, they come with a very negative market value. And that's why they've been asked to come up with collateral. And the doom loop basically started from there. Then the exact same pension fund started selling gilts to try and come up with cash as collateral in these agreements. The yields started accelerating again. The British sterling came under pressure. And ultimately, the Bank of England had to step in with direct intervention in the yield curve. So Darius, is this QE or what is it?
I mean, it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's definitely a duck. I mean, how many times have we seen this before? I mean, I thought it was pretty interesting. Like they made a big sort of a to-do about the Financial Stability Committee along the Bank of England being the sort of the committee that authorized this move, as opposed to the Monetary Policy Committee, which sets, you know, the policy rate and tries to sort of engineer the price stability mandate. What difference does it make? You know, like at the end of the day, the reason we have QE in the first place is because there is an excess of sovereign debt securities, of debt securities globally relative to the demand for them. And is obviously as a function of that, you know, that tends to weigh on broader capital markets to the extent that the, you know, treasuries, you know, the UK Treasury, US Treasury, Bank of Japan, or Ministry of Finance in Japan, et cetera, need to be capitalized. And so, you know, it's our opinion that, you know, to the extent that this program is not, so I actually take a step back. I tweeted, there's nothing is more permanent as a temporary or transitory government program. So we should probably expect that this thing is probably not going anywhere. But let's just, for all, you know, entertain them and say that they're going to allow this to roll off on October 14th. Well, what do you think happens on October 14th or, you know, the days leading into October 14th? There's a fundamental supply demand imbalance on the long end of sovereign debt curves globally. And unless they're willing to come up with a solution that is more permanent in nature, then we're going to continue to see rising bond yields, at least until we get to the point where a recession is something that needs to be risk managed.
Yeah, I think that is a really fair point, Darius. In terms of the question that we asked initially today, whether this situation in the UK is sort of a canary in the coal mine for other countries, what's your take on that? Could we face similar issues in the US and the rest of Europe in, say, 1 to 3 quarters from now?
Yeah, we probably will. you know, so you and I have talked on this program about our secular inflation model, 42 macro, and how that model is, at least in the US, looking at isolating core PCE as the dependent variable, is suggesting that the trend, underlying trend of core PCE on the high end of the estimate range is somewhere just inside of 3%. In terms of that transposition. And so the Fed's going to have an awfully hard time of getting inflation from, let's say, 3% to 2%. I think it's pretty easy to go from 9% to, let's say, 4% or even 3%. But that last 100 to 150, maybe even 200 basis points is likely to be really, really painful in terms of the political damage that they're going to have to do to the unemployment market in order to get it down to the levels that they desire. And so it's our belief that, you know, let's say when we get to that point a year from now, maybe, you know, 15 months or so from now, that they're going to have a very tough political choice to make. And just based on the reading the tea leaves across the globe, you know, the markets are going to force the hands of the central bankers. I do, however, you and I were talking about this earlier, is that I do believe that Europe is probably next. I mean, you had some interesting thoughts on the Italian elections and what that might look like in a few months.
Yeah, let's try and have a look at the situation in the U.S. first before we get to Europe. There is, if we assume that the Federal Reserve will be sort of forced into supporting the U.S. Treasury market, how would that play out? I mean, we would probably need to see more mayhem in the U.S. market before they could actually be forced to step in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and this is the point we make. Brian, if you can pull up slide 37, we sent you where we show the 3-month 10-year yield curve. That, for those who are watching, that is the yield curve you should be paying attention to understand if a recession is imminent and something that's actually a high probability event. The other yield curves give you kind of a general indication of should you be concerned about a recession, but this is the one that tells you if it's actually going to come or not. And it's still, you know, around 41 basis points wide. So it hasn't inverted yet. But obviously, as we roll forward in time, the Fed continues to hike interest rates and the lagged impact of monetary tightening starts to flow through the economy. This is something that could very well be inverted by, let's call it, early next year. And so, you know, it's our belief that the Fed and other central banks effectively need to engineer a recession to bring back that demand component from the private sector to the long end of sovereign debt securities. I mean, one thing we've seen across the board is if you look at, you know, 10-year break-evens or five-year inflation swap rates across all these, you know, major developed market economies, they're running at levels well north of where they were pre-COVID in terms of the trending rate that we observed prior to COVID. And so, again, this is an issue. There's a couple more charts I call out in terms of this fundamental supply-demand issue as it relates to sovereign debt globally. The first chart just kind of highlights, you know, central banks stepping away. So slide 34, Brian, where we show the G5 central bank balance sheet showing it in dollar terms relative to the total equity market capitalization of the globe, relative to the market cap of the Bloomberg Global Aggregate Index. It's not the total stock of bonds, but we're just using that as a proxy. And what we've seen is that, you know, from a balance sheet perspective, you know, G5 central banks, this is the U.S., UK, the Eurozone, Japan, and China, you know, we've seen that that balance sheet decline by roughly $4 trillion since peaking in February. And as a function of that, we've seen, you know, the stocks, if you look at it on a market cap basis, you know, down to $91 trillion relative to $123 trillion in last November, bonds it down at $56 trillion in terms of overall market cap for that index, for that global index, versus $69 trillion in June. You know, there's a real kind of sucking, if you will, of demand out of the system from that side of the equation. Well, that's only half the problem. The other half of the problem is the fiscal authorities are actually creating incremental supply. So that's slide 35 there, Brian, where we show the deviation from the pre-COVID trend, the 2015 to 2019 trend in each of those select countries' sovereign budget balance as a percent of GDP. So a positive reading would indicate that the budget deficit got tighter. A negative reading indicates the budget deficit got wider. And as you can see, U.S. at minus 96%, Germany at minus 390 basis points, or sorry, not 96 basis points, France minus 182 basis points, Italy minus 409 basis points, Spain at minus 146, and the UK at minus 167 basis points. The whole developed world is seeing its budget deficits widen as a function of this sort of lurching left with respect to fiscal policy. So there's a real fundamental supply and demand imbalance. The fiscal authorities are giving you more paper, central banks are stepping back, and as long as we're not in a recession, particularly in the U.S., there's not really a lot of demand for these securities in the private sector.
I think we can bring up chart three as well, Brian. I've tried to sort of calculate the energy cost as a percent of GDP in Europe this year, and it basically fits the story that you just depicted for European sovereign debt. Because, I mean, given the energy bill that we will be faced with this winter, it's quite likely that politicians will simply have to step in and bail out parts of the private sector as a consequence of these rising energy bills. And if we take a look at countries that we haven't talked about yet, Germany, just to take an example, 10% of GDP is the likely bill for energy in 2022. And that compares to levels just south of 2% in 2020.
What? Yeah. 800 basis points?
Yeah, that's good the Lord. Incremental increase in the cost of energy over a couple of years. And I haven't even considered the risk of a falling GDP number here. It's just a crazy move. And I mean, the reason why the UK market started accelerating in terms of yields was probably that the UK administration decided to bail out this entire energy bill, right? So to me, it could be sort of a clear warning signal of what could be upcoming in the rest of Europe. The energy bill in the US is much lower than this. Let me just emphasize that as well.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
I wanted to add a thing in relation to your G5 chart. There is today we had action from Bank of England, so direct intervention in the yield curve. The Bank of Japan is still easing. The People's Bank of China is sort of in easing mode as well, while the European Central Bank could be forced to buy bonds again already this winter. Maybe, let's say maybe. Then we have the Federal Reserve left, the most important of them all. I mean, right now we have interest rate hikes and bond buying at the same time in the UK. Could you imagine something like that happening in the US?
No. The reason I say it's very likely that by the time we have that issue, it's very likely the Fed will already be done hiking interest rates. You know, I think the if you look at money market rates, you know, they're sort of split on December and February being kind of the last rate hike for this particular tightening cycle. So it's unlikely that, you know, by then we're going to have that kind of issue in the Treasury market. And there's other things that the Treasury can do. They've talked about, they floated this idea of doing a debt swap in terms of issuing bills to buy back longer term debt securities and kind of ease some pressure on the long end of the curve. So it's not clear to me that the Fed, just given how aggressive the guidance has been from Chairman Powell on getting inflation back to their 2% target, it's very unlikely that they would be so quiescent to allowing that to occur at so soon. I could very easily see a scenario, however, next year where instead of, you know, if they have to opt for easing, and again, we think this is probably a second half of 23 story at the earliest, could be an early 24 story. If they opt for easing, it's probably going to come in the form of QE rather than in the form of, not even QE, just stopping the quantitative tightening rather than the form of rate cuts. Because again, it's based on Powell's assessment of the dynamics through the 1970s inflation episode, it's the duration with which interest rates have to remain restrictive, at least from their perspective, in order to get inflation under control. That seems to be the dominant variable driving the policy decisions they're making today.
But given what we've just discussed with a central bank in the UK now buying bonds directly in the market again, paired with a Federal Reserve still very sort of convincingly telling us that the monetary policy will have to be tighter for longer, we have a policy divergence gap that we haven't seen for decades, more or less, right? And obviously, we get moves in FX space as a consequence there. Is what do you make of that divergence and the moves that we see in the US dollar?
Well, I mean, the FX is the channel, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the release valve for a lot of this, you know, this incremental pressure coming from fiscal authorities. And the incremental pressure they're applying indirectly or directly upon monetary authorities to sort of to acquiesce to their demands. One thing I found pretty interesting, and this is not good, but we saw Brian Deese, who's the White House economic economic council director, or whatever, I forget this title, they all have too many titles, but he's one of these important people in the White House on the economic side. And he came out and said this morning, hey, we're not even considering something that looks like a Plaza Accord, right? And so, you know, I put up a chart, Brian, slide 33, in that chart where we show the long-term time series of the dollar monthly candles on the DXY, that's the US dollar index, mostly Euro, Japanese yen, British pound, and that. And as you can see, just in terms of the upper panel in that chart, you know, we're nowhere near the levels that, you know, caused the Plaza Accord in terms of the strength of the dollar, not only in terms of levels, but in terms of the persistency of the rise. I mean, you go back to the Plaza Accord, the dollar was rising for five straight years in a straight line. You know, that's, you know, we're basically a year and 15 months into a dollar bull market from that perspective, in terms of the lows we saw in the middle of last year. One thing that's also typically associated with currency interventions is high currency volatility. Central bankers, fiscal authorities, in terms of Ministry of Finances, they want to tamp down that volatility because that tends to be harmful for capital investment and capital flows, et cetera. And so if you look at 30-day implied volatility on the DXY, we're only at 9%. Now, that's you know, reasonably high relative to the recent past, but, you know, we were at 17%. You know, right just ahead of the Plaza Accord back in the mid 80s. And then lastly, on a year-over-year basis, you know, this is probably the one thing that is causing the most concern amongst investors and policymakers. It's just the speed of the ascent on a year-over-year basis. We're up 20% year-over-year. We were up 25% year-over-year in terms of the Plaza Accord, where we were in the mid 80s. But again, that was up 25% on a compounded five-year bull run in the dollar. So if investors are expecting to see, you know, policymakers capitulate on their inflation drives and really start to bail out international capital markets, the global economy, I think we need to see a lot more pain, both economically and financial markets, before before they opt for that solution.
In relation to the euro leg of the euro versus the US dollar foreign exchange rate, I wanted to play a soundbite for you from a discussion I had with an Italian professor the other day. And we have a discussion around the recent election in Italy leading to a right-wing coalition, and the risk of fiscal largesse in the Italian administration as a consequence of this election. So let's listen to Andrea Palcinieri and get back to this discussion.
On the energy side, if you ask me, then I can tell you my opinion. You will not have a lot of changes, because at the end of the day, it's very difficult that you can take some decision, for example, related to the cap alone. You will have to join the European Union in any kind of decision, otherwise it will be a disaster for a single country. So this is my perception. At the end of the day, a lot of public campaign, a lot of talks, but you know, I'm not sure they will do, you know, something without Europe. And this is from the energy side. But on the Italia side, I would say on macro side, then the public campaign told me that they want to spend. They want to spend a lot. Think about the potential flat tax, or think about, you know, they want to do a lot of investments. And so the public spending, I'm okay with that, but I am not sure that I have a lot of covering for that. And this is my, you know, what I'm thinking right now. So they win the public spend, but, you know, the problem with the deficit and the debt to GDP will be higher. I have also to be honest, over the last 3 to 4 weeks, the same Giorgia Meloni tried to, you know, reassure the market, telling them that we are not stupid and we well know that we need to stay within the European framework. So I do think that at the end of the day, they will make those decisions within the EU framework. Otherwise, you know, we go back to the previous point and the two protection, you know, the TPI, so the two protect Italy mechanism, we all called it in Italy. So the TPI instrument, you know, for the ECB could come in action. That's the point, Andreas.
The entire interview with Andrea Palcininieri is already available at Real Vision for subscribers. And remember that we just launched the Make or Break series, a must watch if you ask me. But back to you, Darius. I mean, Andrea's point here is basically that there is a clear risk that the new Italian administration will run a huge budget deficit. And ultimately, the ECB will have to step in again to save the Italian bond market. We obviously already touched upon this risk, but what do you make of this risk in an FX perspective?
Oh, I mean, it's obviously very bearish. So let me start by saying I'm going to borrow a phrase that I absolutely hate, but I'm going to use it for this particular discussion. But the end game for all of this is fiscal or monetary authorities capitalizing fiscal authorities to dig us out of this, you know, sort of supply deficit that we have, whether it be, you know, commodities or physical goods or restructuring the, you know, supply chains, reshoring supply chains. We have a lot of big changes we need to get in, we need to affect over the next, let's call it 3, 5, 7, 9 years. And the reality is it's going to be very difficult to get the private sector to wrap its hands around a lot of these issues. And so ultimately the monetary authorities, as much as, you know, it doesn't make sense today with inflation at 9% in the US and Eurozone or north of that in the UK, that's where we're headed with all this. Now, again, you have to risk manage that as an investor along the way. You can't just put that trade on and expect to, you know, make money on a 2029, 2030 outcome. But the reality is this is where we're headed. But so in terms of the very near term dynamics of this, obviously, is more dollar strength. If you think about, you know, kind of what has to happen in terms of, you know, in terms of what could potentially happen on the Italian budget side, which, again, this is a hypothetical. But very clearly, we've seen this is a Christine Lagarde led ECB that very much is very still tethered to the concept of financial stability, and which is an implicit tethering to their implicit growth mandate. You know, one final chart I bring up is slide 36. Where we show the G4 X or G5 central banks ex US balance sheets in their local currency terms. And one thing that's pretty different with respect to the ECB's balance sheet is that, you know, it's still sort of, you know, it's not really climbing, but it's not having the decline that we've seen, you know, with other balance sheets like the Bank of England, whose balance sheet peaked in January, the Bank of Japan's peaked in June, and the PBOC's peaked in February. So, you know, this might be a case where the ECB is forced to abandon, and I think the market has already gotten to this point, which is the ECB is going to be forced to abandon its inflation drive sooner than I think it probably wishes going to be able to.
Yeah, I perfectly agree.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Darius, as always, we have a bunch of questions for you. Since it's been a crazy day in FX markets in particular, we have a lot of questions from people interested in how to sort of shield oneself against this volatility in FX space. I can say as a European, I've shielded myself by having a lot of dollar positions throughout the year. It's been a sort of an easy hedge for me from European soil. But when you look at this FX volatility seen from US soil, what do you make of that volatility?
No, it's great. I mean, look, we said this in January on the show. US dollar cash is king. Mm. And it's become increasingly king. Obviously, today it's taken a little breather. I mean, it was egregiously overbought, whether you look at our probable ranges or, you know, long bow ranges or any ranges, you know, it was egregiously overbought. So, you know, a lot of what we saw in the last couple of weeks was, you know, in terms of Europe moving incrementally left in terms of monetary and fiscal policy, Fed getting incrementally tight in terms of monetary policy, all that stuff got very much priced in from a short-term tactical perspective. But the trend is going to remain intact until the market is comfortable with the idea of a U.S. recession. And it's not. And going back to the yield curve chart we discussed, but if you just look at the data, I mean, yesterday was a slap in the face to anyone, you know, who spends, you know, 6-7 hours a day on Twitter talking about the next crisis. You know, we had consumer confidence rip, a CapEx rip, you know, it was a core capital goods new orders in the U.S. For those of you who aren't paying attention to the data, are up 12% on a 3-month annualized rate of change basis and accelerating. Like that's the least recessionary data point I've heard in months. You got PMIs in the low to mid 50s. If you look at the ISMs, like all the stuff that people should be paying attention to, but they're not paying attention to because they spend all day on Twitter. You know, this is a U.S. economy that on a 3-month annualized basis, looking at monthly statistics, nominal GDP is at around 8 to 9% in the U.S. economy. We're going to find that out on Friday. And we're going to update on that on Friday in terms of the PCE spending data. Now, all the data is slowing, but we're so far away from levels that would indicate this economy is about to fall off a cliff. You know, obviously the labor market being kind of like the prime suspect in this whole discussion. So I think we just need to move forward in time for a lot of these bear, you know, for lack of a better phrase, bear porn narratives to come to fruition. They're probably going to come to fruition. They just don't have to come to fruition today or tomorrow or next week. This is going to be a long, elongated process. You know, we could be talking about a lot of the same themes a year from now, if we want to be honest with ourselves.
If we assume that the US dollar will keep strengthening, at which point do you think the US dollar turns into an issue for the US equity market? I mean, we know that some of the companies have earnings abroad, right? So is a strong US dollar an issue for the US equity market in general?
Yes and no. I mean, look, it's obviously an issue for earnings, but you know, two things I've noticed this throughout my career. Maybe it's not the case at this particular juncture because the dollar is a little bit stronger. It's almost as strong as it's been in nearly 20 years. So this might be out the window. But generally speaking, investors, you know, write off currency fluctuations when it comes to earnings, both good and bad. So that tends to be the case. But one thing I would call out with respect to near-term earnings, not 2023 earnings. I think the real earnings discussion should be focused and centered around 2023, because I think that's where a lot of the pent up slowing of growth to below trend status is likely to occur. But in between now and then, you still have nominal GDP running at 8 to 9%, employment cost index running at 6%. That's a pretty healthy spread. It's almost a record wide spread. We're coming off of a record wide spread in terms of corporate's ability to sort of shield their earnings and shield their cash flows, you know, from some of these inflationary dynamics. So that's a long-winded way of saying if you're bear on earnings, it's probably not going to be Q3 earnings season that gets you paid. It's probably going to be Q1 or Q2 earnings season of 2023.
We have a couple of questions coming in again on what happened in the Baltic Sea yesterday with the blow up of the Nord Stream pipelines. I mean, Darius, I want to pick your brain on how you view this situation from an energy perspective. We've obviously seen almost a landslide in most commodity prices since midsummer. But what do you make of this sabotage in the Baltic Sea? Is it something that we should worry about in general?
Yeah, I mean, look, so it's we've seen the proposed response to this from the European Council, which is more Russian sanctions. They're floating that the idea to cap Russian energy exports, et cetera. I don't know how that's going to work out, because, again, we've seen some of these side deals get orchestrated, whether it be Russia, China, Russia, India, Russia, Pakistan, et cetera, Russia, Iran, in terms of, you know, kind of skirting some of these sanctions. You know, at the end of the day, this goes back to the comment I made, you know, earlier, which is, we're moving to a multipolar world where it's going to be increasingly every country for themselves, every region for themselves, every bloc for themselves. And ultimately, this is just another step in that process. Now, it's not all bad, but at least in terms of where we are today, not really understanding what that world's going to look like from a final state perspective, there's still a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty is going to keep volatility high. And it's in the context of a negatively sloped net liquidity function, it's not good. We're not in a good situation for asset markets. It just doesn't mean we have to go to, let's say, 3,000 on the S&P or 13,000 on Bitcoin in the next couple of months. This could be something that takes, you know, another 6 to 9 months to play out, is all I'm saying.
I'd actually say that Bitcoin has been surprisingly stable in the past couple of weeks relative to the mayhem that we've seen in other asset markets, at least when you look at it from a volatility adjusted perspective. Final question from the audience, which is a really good one, if you ask me. We've had direct intervention, let's say in the 10-year point and in the 30-year point in the UK yield curve today. Is this a signal that we've peaked in terms of 10 and 30-year bond yields in the US?
No. It's unlikely to be the signal. Now, again, we put this in our research. We talked about this, said, hey, look, when we kiss 4%, which we called for, investors are going to come out of the woodwork and try to buy the dip. It's the equivalent of, like, you know, hitting 4,000 on the S&P, right? Everyone's going to, you know, every long-term bull on U.S. stocks, or, you know, person who thinks there's value in the long end of the curve is going to see that level and get excited about it. But a lot of the structural dynamics underpinning that supply and demand imbalance that we talked about earlier in the show are still very much in place. And it's especially if the U.K., you know, sort of this program actually does prove to be temporary and it's gone by, you know, October 15th. Now, again, I don't believe it's gone anywhere because, you know, again, there's nothing more permanent than a government program, than a temporary government program. But anyway, let's say that removes some of the selling pressure, or at least so that alleviates some of the supply demand imbalance. The reality is there's still going to be supply demand imbalance associated with growth broadly slowing across the developed world, fiscal authorities getting incrementally more sort of, you know, kind of convicted in that they need to do something to respond to the growth slowdown. And ultimately, and obviously we were negative on asset prices, risk assets on a trending basis. And so as asset markets continue to, you know, demonstrate volatility and you start to see the level of general concern and angst and anxiety rise, fiscal authorities are going to want to do even more. And so that this likelihood that we still are in this scenario where there is a supply demand imbalance in the bond market until a recession, particularly in the U.S. economy, is something that the bond market is actually concerned about, because I would argue it's not. That supply demand imbalance is going to persist. So, you know, are we going 4 or 5 on the U.S. 10-year? I don't know, but I wouldn't rule it out. I certainly wouldn't rule it out, because again, a lot of the dynamics that are underpinning this massive up move we've seen in bond yields, that's likely to continue.
Yeah, this was another great discussion, Darius. So let me try and sum up a bit towards the end here. We asked the question initially whether this mayhem in UK bond markets could be sort of a canary in the coal mine for the rest of the world. And I think the two of us agree that the next target could be Europe. Mainland Europe, and namely Italy. This is potentially a canary in the coal mine for other regions globally, but there is a region running, if not on all cylinders still, then at least at a very decent pace, that is the US. So we shouldn't expect this to hit US soil anytime soon. And that's essentially why the US dollar is so strong against other currencies, because we have this massive policy divergence as a consequence of this easing scene in the UK relative to a tighter for longer narrative by the Federal Reserve. Anything you want to add to that summary, Darius?
Not at all, man. You're one of the best. That was awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us once again today. It's always a pleasure to host you.
Appreciate you, brother. Thank you. Great. Thanks for everyone for tuning in. I know it's a lot going on out there, but, you know, we're going to be here for you. We're going to try to answer as many questions as we can, and catch you back here next week.
Yeah, and let's conclude with a meme, as always, Darius. So I found a meme describing the current policy mix in the UK perfectly. Bank of England is now the only marginal buyer of the UK sovereign debt. So I guess this meme is the perfect way to reflect that. Didi, once again, thank you. And thank you out there for watching. My colleagues will be back with more tomorrow in the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
The Sri Lankan Prime Minister's house set alight.
First is authoritarianism. The second is corruption.
The FOMC is strongly resolved to bring inflation down to 2%.
Home builders are abandoning homes.
Massive protests going on here.
We're going to see a material impact here on growth and indeed on earnings, which my colleague...
Change is happening and you can fear it.
But you're not going to stop it.
There are really only two countries in Europe that have managed to maintain a replacement level birth rate, France and Sweden.
This is the biggest bubble in the history of the world, and you have no clue.
It's all herd mentality. It's the same as the property market.
What happens over the next few months could define what happens over the next few years. So we want to make sure that you understand why.
You've probably realized that we really have been listening to you.